We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.
Well, a very pleasant good morning to you. Welcome to part two of our show. We get underway here right around 9 o'clock Central Time, and then generally have a couple of different guests, and second one comes on in the neighborhood of 10:30. We're not real persnickety as we live stream. I mean, these days everybody kind of watches things when they want anyway, right? That's the way of the world. Well, it's good to have you here. It is August 25 as we live stream on our website, oneradionetwork.com, also on Facebook and YouTube. And if you'd like to comment, we like Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. That's our favorite way. It comes right into my computer, but you can also call. And I know that it doesn't involve your thumbs, but try it. You might like it. It is 888-663-6386. We've been very blessed over the years to spend, 15, 20 years spending weekly our shows with Andrew Goss, currency historian, author of a couple of books, including The Secret World of Money, a classic. And we learned a lot over the years. And so we got a pretty good background with monetary history, and you do. We have big fans of Andrew. We have 12 years of his shows. He's now gone on to his next adventure in another reality. So we have a pretty good background, but there's people out there like Robert Murphy who are digging in and looking at things and giving us some real in-depth research and kind of telling us where the bodies are buried and this whole thing about money and the gold standard. And it's quite poignant these days because I think there's probably, and I'm just conjecturing here, maybe $3 or $4 trillion new dollars that have come into existence via the Federal Reserve since this whole COVID thing started, 6-8 months ago. I don't know if that's a fair number, and Robert will probably have some ideas on that. I haven't checked the balance sheet on the Fed lately. I'll probably pull it up while we're on the air, the H-4-1 release. But Robert Murphy is here. He's a senior fellow with the Mises Institute. He's author of many books. His latest is the Contra Krugman, Smashing the Errors of America's Most Famous Keynesian. Krugman, of course, is the financial guy that works for the president, and he's going to tell us what Keynesian is. Chaos Theory, Lessons for the Young Economist, and Choice, Cooperation, Enterprise, and Human Action. The Mises is a pretty interesting place, and I'm going to ask Robert to tell us about it, Mises.org. Robert Murphy, very pleasant good morning to you, sir, and welcome to the show. And thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Patrick. Glad to do it.
Yeah. Now tell folks who are not familiar with Mises, M-I-S-E-S, who was Mises, von Mises? He was a libertarian kind of hard metal guy, money guy?
Sure. So he was a member of what's called the Austrian School of Economics. And Mises wrote several really important books in the 20th century. So one was called The Theory of Money and Credit that came out in 1912. That was sort of like his doctoral dissertation, if you will.
Yeah.
He wrote a very important book on socialism. Well, the article came out and the book came out on socialism, where he basically launched what's called the socialist calculation debate. And then his magnum opus is Human Action, that maybe some of your listeners have heard of, and that the English version of that came out in 1949. Mises was a proponent of gold money. What's interesting is in his book on monetary theory, the one that came out in 1912, he has a classification scheme. He's got what he calls commodity money, credit money, and then fiat money. And he says something like, even though it hasn't ever existed really, we have to admit the possibility that there could be this thing called fiat money. So like in his mind, he really thought of money as being a commodity. And this idea that there could just be paper money that's not backed up by anything with no expectation of ever being backed up, to him was sort of anathema. So yes, he's a great economist and monetary theorist, I would say. His claim to fame in terms of economic science is he took what was called subjective value theory that had been invented in the 1870s and used it to solve the problem of the value of money. So that was like the technical accomplishment in his 1912 work.
So the Austrian school, and we have Richard Mayberry on once a month. You know Richard Mayberry? He's an Austrian guy. So tell folks what that is. The basic premise behind the Austrian school of of economics. What's really your guiding light, you Austrian school guys?
Well, sure. So the Austrian school is a school of thought, just like there's the Keynesian school or the Chicago school. Mm-hmm. The name, of course, it's not that we study, you know, output in Vienna. It's that the founders from the school happened to originally have been Austrian, and that's where the label
comes
from.
That's where it comes from, yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of, like, policy conclusions, it's fair to say Austrians tend to be very free market libertarian types, but it is, you know, a scientific school of thought. I would say, like, the biggest difference between Austrians and even, like, Chicago school types, who tend to be pretty laissez-faire in their policy prescriptions, is when it comes to explaining what causes the business cycle. And this was another thing that Ludwig von Mises developed. It was his theory that now is like the canonical Austrian view. And so Mises said that, you know, interest rates are prices, they serve a function. And so when the central bank and the commercial banks flood the market with cheap credit and push our interest rates artificially low, that sets up an unsustainable boom. And so in the Austrian view, when, you know, these business cycles keep happening, the issue is not like during a slump to say, oh, what should the government or the Fed do to promote recovery? And the Keynesian answer is to run a budget deficit or to slash interest rates. And the Austrians say, no, the problem is occurring during the boom period. That's when all these unsustainable investment projects are started. Businesses hire workers and put them into niches where it's unsustainable, and you're setting yourself up for a crash. So if you want to stop the business cycle, you got to stop these booms, and then that's the way you get rid of the bust. Ironically, the bust period is like the cleansing process in the Austrian view. That's when, you know, things go back to where they should be, even though it's painful.
And the booms, Robert Murphy, would be when the government goes out and borrows more money, or especially when the Fed monetizes and creates the money. Those are the boom things. Like, what is this? What's keeping the market? I don't want to get. Is this what's keeping the market up now, all this new money?
Right. In my judgment, yes. And you're right, Patrick. Earlier, I just looked it up while you were doing the intro. So the Fed, just in the last 5 months or so, has added about $3 trillion in assets to its balance sheet.
That's a T, right?
And so, yes, there's T, trillion with a T. So, yes, there's a sense in which the Fed has created $3 trillion of what's called high-powered money. And yes, I think you're right that, you know, the stock market crashed, then it bounced right back. And I think that's almost entirely a result of the Fed just printing money, mm-hmm. or electronically creating money. It doesn't even print it anymore. Just like during the Obama years, if you look at a graph of the S&P 500 against the Fed's balance sheet, they move almost in tandem to the various rounds of quantitative easing.
Yeah, I see here the Fed is now, what, at $7 trillion. And I guess they were, what was it? Was it, Rob? Were they about $4 trillion or $3.5 trillion at the end of the year, in that range on their balance sheet?
Right. Yeah.
So that's new. Yes. That's new Dell 586 computer money, right? Just poof.
Right. Yeah. So it's the way it works. It's pretty straightforward. When the Federal Reserve buys assets, legally speaking, they just credit. You know, the Fed, in a sense, writes a check drawn on the Federal Reserve and then buys assets. And so the recipient who sells it, you know, mortgage-backed securities or the treasuries, deposits the check. You know, if it's some investment bank or something, they deposit the check, and then their checking account with the Fed goes up by whatever the transaction was, $1 million. And that $1 million doesn't get debited from somewhere else, right? It just gets added to the recipient's account with the Fed, but the Fed has an unlimited amount of points, right? Because it's not, you know, there's no gold backing it up anymore. It's just electronic, I say. And so the Fed has the legal ability to do that. And the only thing constraining it is they think, well, if we abuse this privilege, then the dollar would crash. But there's no legal constraint on how many assets they can buy.
Right. And what was it, the Monetary Decontrol Act? Was it in 80 or so? That's when they really were able to buy treasuries, right? Before then, they didn't buy treasuries. Is that close? Do you know?
I know what you're alluding to, and there have been statutory changes in terms of what the Fed can buy. So I don't have the exact dates of those things at my fingertips. But no, I think it was earlier than that they were buying treasury. I will say this: part of what the revolution, as it were, of what happened after the 08 crisis is up for a long time, it had been established that what the central bank bought would be government bonds. And then it was because the temptation to corruption was so extreme. Obviously, if the New York Fed could buy stocks or bonds issued by Wall Street, you know, things that were listed on the S&P 500, the temptation for corruption. But now those lines are being blurred with the Fed, you know, buying corporate debt at this point. So things that would have been unthinkable in 2007 now are commonplace.
Is it fair to say that most Americans in the 90% range believe that the Fed and the government are one and the same?
I'm not sure. So definitely a couple decades ago, that would be true.
But not today.
Because, and I don't know what the percentage would be. But yes, I think certainly, like I know the Ron Paul campaign really stressed it, that, and with all the things going on after the 2008 crisis, I mean, just Ben Bernanke going on 60 Minutes and trying to calm people and say, don't worry, we're not going to kill the I mean, that was unheard of. The Fed was like this boring thing in the corner that no one thought about up until 2008. And so to answer your question, I certainly a growing number of people are aware that the Fed is this strange entity. And you're right. It's this weird quasi-private public thing where it's literally owned by banks, like private shareholders own stock in the Fed. But yet, you know, its leadership is appointed and confirmed by the federal government. So it is a weird, it's not Walmart, but it's also not the Pentagon.
Yeah, a kind of a giant squid kind of thing. Well, wasn't Powell, he was recently on 60 Minutes too. And he said, we digitally create, he said it right on 60 Minutes. He
didn't. Right.
Bernanke quite didn't go there, did he? He said, no, we don't create money, but... So your article that we're going to talk about, this is great, folks. If you really want to dig into some history, this is really cool. If you go to Mises.org, and we're going to have the link right on our show page, so you just click on it, and it's a brief history of the gold standard with a focus on the United States, written by Robert Murphy. This must have taken quite a job for you to put this baby together. You really dug in and deep on this one.
Yeah, I did actually in this one. So what this is from, this is the third chapter in this. I'm doing it serially and not necessarily in order. This booklet on understanding money mechanics for the Mises Institute. And this one, you know, I went into it to say, oh, yeah, we're going to do a quick history of the gold standard. And I thought I was just going to focus on some of the major things like FDR and 33 and, you know, Nixon and 71. But as I got into it, I realized, well, no, I got to explain, you know, gold and silver, bimetallism and all these things. So yes, to answer your question, this one I did have to do a fair bit of research on because I didn't know all these details until I sat down to write this chapter.
So this chapter is going to be a chapter in a booklet that the Mises is going to offer to help folks to read and actually figure out how this whole thing works.
Right. Yeah. We start with like, what does the Federal Reserve do? You know, this is the basic mechanics of it. Like, what's changed since the 2008 crisis? What about shadow banking? Uh-huh. What about the people who say, you know, the textbook explanation is that, oh, the Fed buys assets, creates reserves, then banks lend on top of that. Whereas there's like an alternate approach. This is, no, it's the other way around, that people's deposits are the thing that fuels reserves. And right. So anyway, just dealing with a lot of things just to bring people up to speed about how does money and banking work in the modern age, in response to critics of like the so-called orthodox view.
If you have a question for Robert P. Murphy, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com or 888-663-6386. So what is this compilation going to be called on Mises when it's done that people can look for? What do you have a name for it yet?
Yeah, I think it's called Understanding Money Mechanics.
Ooh, okay.
So if people just Google that, they should find it. So right now there's like, I think 12 of the chapters are already up there. So it's like got the table of contents, and every time a new chapter posts, like,
oh,
that gets hyper-like.
I see. So it's kind of work in progress online. That's pretty cool. I like that. Understanding.
Right, yeah. So every month or so we release a new chapter.
Is it, boy, that'd be a great thing for homeschoolers, wouldn't it? Boy, if kids could understand, whew, man, that would be a big one, wouldn't it?
Exactly, yeah, and especially we're excited with, you know, it's the context is unfortunate, but with all these people, you know, being forced to stay home from school, a lot more parents are turning to homeschooling, And yeah, we've got lots of material, and we hope that they can get a solid grounding in economic fundamentals.
How did gold and silver play into what was termed as money way back, if we go back to revolution, like pre King George, get out of the, you know,
right.
you know, go pound sure. sand. What was going on with the money? What were the colonists using?
Sure. So the actual, you know, the colonists, one of the 13 colonies, they, as colonies of the British Crown, you know, legally speaking, they were formally using the British Empire's money, which was officially silver at that point. And if you just think about it, like, it's called the pound sterling, right? That's Britain's money.
Right.
And think about those terms. It connotes a physical weight of silver. And that's, you know, way back in the day, that's literally what it meant, 1 pound of silver. And then it got, you know, debased over time. But it was pretty laissez-faire in the sense that there was all kinds of money from all over the world that the colonists used. And they also would use tobacco and things like that, especially in rural areas.
Uh-huh.
Like, so the bigger cities would tend to use coin. But, you know, if you were in Virginia somewhere, you know, you might just use tobacco as the money. And one of the more popular coins that they used was the Spanish silver dollar.
Hmm.
And so that's why Americans tended to use the term dollar as opposed to the pound and shilling.
That's
and
where the word came
such.
From. That's where the
and it was from the Spanish silver dollar, because that was the coin that they used. Mm-hmm. I guess just because it was a very versatile coin, and it, you know, that was its attributes were good that made it, you know, very useful and convenient. And so then when they wrote the Constitution, the framers said, "Hey, because Americans have this term dollar, and that's pretty widespread. Why don't we just say that that's, you know, the unit of the money?"
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution gives the federal government the power to coin money, and that's important. I think a lot of people they think that the Constitution's giving the government the power to print dollars, but that's, if you read it, it says coin money.
Coin money.
And so that's what they thought money was coin. And then I think it was 1792 was the Coinage Act that defined how many grains of silver constituted a dollar and how many grains of gold constituted $10. So you could divide by 10.
Yeah.
And that established a 15-to-1 ratio. So as of 1792, the U.S. dollar was defined in terms of silver and or gold content. And I want to stress this.
Go ahead.
It wasn't like it was pegged. You know what I mean? Like, nowadays we kind of think of it as the dollar is this floating thing, and maybe the government, to try to ensure stability, might peg it, you know, the way like a South American government might peg their currency to the dollar. But no, here they were defining the dollar, right? It's sort of like defining.
This is it.
A foot is 12 inches. You know what I mean? So it was a more fundamental thing back then, where like the precious metals were money, and national currencies were defined in terms of the precious metals.
Like 371 grains for silver, 24 grains for gold. I left off the fractions. So that was a 15-to-1 ratio. And we'll talk about the ratio as it exists today, right, between gold and silver. And that's kind of fun to look at. That was back in 1792. So you're saying, and then what about Article 2, Section 10, let no state make gold and silver a payment in debt? I mean, that was pretty key thing, right? Why did they put that in there?
Right. So just for the listeners, another, in the Constitution, there was, I think it was in the contract clause, it said that the states, it forbade them from printing paper money,
mm-hmm.
and said that they could only make gold and silver coin legal payment to settle debts.
Yes.
Okay. So again, clearly the Constitution has this idea that what the money is going to be in this, you know, new country constituted, you know, under the federal government of the U.S. Constitution, the money was gold and silver, and part of the reason for that, we think, is that during the war for American independence, you know, remember there's a Continental Congress, and they did issue paper money that was called a Continental currency. You know, like paying the troops, they'd print up money and pay them.
Right.
And because of the temptation for inflation, like once they severed the link between the continental currency and the precious metals, the temptation just to run the printing press was too much. And so that debased the currency, and that gave rise to the phrase or the expression, not worth a continental.
Not worth
some of your listeners might have heard that. Yeah. And that's where that comes from, that realizing that, like, the people could see how prices quoted in continental currency kept going up, that the currency became worth less and less as they just kept printing more and more of it to pay soldiers and whatnot. And so, you know, the phrase, oh yeah, that's not worth a continental. So the founders, having just directly experienced that, said, okay, we want the currency of this new nation to be on a sound footing. So it's got to be gold or silver. It, you know, can't be paper money, because that's the government abuses that privilege too easily.
When the Constitution says let no state, where does that put the Fed? At that point, Robert Murphy, is the state the government, or you know, federal government, considered a state as well, or were they just telling the states they had to make gold and silver?
Right. So I'm not a constitutional scholar, but my understanding of the language is they were saying the federal government has the power to coin money, right, and to proclaim, you know, define weights and measures. And that was all. So just like, you know, they could just say, okay, you know, what's a foot? It's 12 inches, or what's a pound? You know, they could
do that.
So like just think about it. And I think it was in terms of, like, just for people making contracts. Like, if I say I'm going to buy 3 pounds of wheat from you, or what, three bushels of wheat from, and pay you $20, like,
what's
we
a
need
bushel?
To know what are those terms mean.
What's,
you know,
a bushel?
Exactly. What's a dollar? Yeah. And so it's determined in terms of physical things, you know, and so just for contract enforcement. So I think that was the mentality. And then they also said that, yeah, and wait, we don't want the state governments going and issuing their own paper currencies and doing things, or to be able to say, oh, in Virginia, if somebody owes you $100, they can just pay you in paper money. To say, no, that if somebody owes you dollars,
you gotta pay
legally
me.
It can only be satisfied with gold
because
or silver.
Because dollars are gold and silver, whereas so many grains. But
right.
Back then, were there forces that were suggesting or believed that, well, okay, well, we'll just do the paper as long as it's backed by gold or silver, and then you don't have to carry around these heavy things and all. Was that an accepted idea?
Okay, so this is a subtle point. I'm glad you raised it.
Yeah.
So in terms of the federal government, they did not issue paper notes that were legal money, at least until the Civil War. It was called the Greenback.
The Greenback,
and
right.
So that's when the federal government, sort of asterisk on that, is they did for the War of 1812, they issued treasury notes.
Yes.
So strictly speaking, those were debt instruments, just like a treasury bond right now is not the same thing as
dollars.
And
people traded them. Right.
But you could like pay your taxes with them and stuff. So like, you know, you could say they're borderline. But clearly, I want your listeners to realize the federal government, by and large, was making physical coins that had silver and gold in them that said, you know, $1, quarter dollar, $10 piece, like if it was a gold eagle piece that was, you know, $10. So that's what the money was the federal government made. Now, what was true was commercial banks could issue bank notes. And so there, you know, so like you say, if you had $50 in gold, you wouldn't want to be walking around with that in your cart, you know, that your horse was drawn around, because you'd be vulnerable to being robbed. So you could deposit that with a bank, and maybe they would
give you
paper, like, to prove, you know, if you had to go do a big transaction, yeah, maybe you would sign things and it would show, okay, my bank's going to transfer the gold that they are holding for me into your account. Just like right nowadays, you know, we write checks without carrying a bunch of cash around. So that was true, but those bank notes were not legal tender. You see what I mean? Like, in other words, that wasn't official money the way $100 bill.
You could trade them
money.
And all that stuff. Like, Robert, I'm going to give you this and whatever. But it wasn't really legal tender. That's important, right?
Right. Exactly.
Those treasury things.
Right. So, yes.
And so, but so, the Constitution says,
like a merchant.
Go ahead.
A merchant could. So somebody went into a general store and wanted to buy something that was $2. If they plunked down two silver dollar coins, clearly the merchant would say, oh, yeah, that's good. Whereas if the person took out notes issued from a bank, depending on the merchant and the bank, he might say, I've never heard of that bank. That's not good here.
Right.
He would have the right to do that. That's what the distinction I'm making. So yes, people did use paper money, but technically it was bank notes issued by commercial banks up until, like I say, the Civil War. The federal government, the money it created for Americans to use, was gold and silver coins.
Yeah. So the Constitution definitely says that the government can't emit bills of credit, right? I mean, they were pretty clear about that, correct? Were they just thinking, if you just give the government the ability to create paper notes, then who knows what they'll do? Inflation?
Yes. So I think you're right. And again, though, it's the federal government certainly had the power to issue bonds, to issue debt. But I believe they were making a clear distinction and saying, you know, that's not the money per
legal,
se.
Legal tender. Of course, Jefferson right, said something right. like, well, if the government can issue a treasury note, they can issue a note. Remember that line by Jefferson. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess. So where did it start where, in your article, The History of the Gold Standard, where it became okay for the government or the central banks, either one, you tell us, to create notes that had an actual gold exchangeable, you know, you could exchange them. How did that all start? And did people accept that? And were there people like you around saying, well, you better be careful here because, you know, this could get out of control if you have these paper that are representing a certain amount of gold?
Right. So during the Civil War, you know, they issued greenbacks that were not backed, you know,
nothing,
they weren't
right?
tied. And then, right. And but even there, like, there was the expectation that eventually people would return. So that's why I was saying, like, Mises in 1912 in his book was saying, you know, it's unclear whether historically there's ever been an example of a true fiat money. Because even though plenty of government had gone off gold and silver during wars, the public always thought, okay, eventually they're going to come back.
Like, so the greenbacks.
Mises thought that still that. That link to silver is like in your mind in the future. So yeah, with the Civil War, it was in 1875 they passed the Specie Redemption Act that said by 1879 everything's got to be back tied to gold.
Oh really?
Okay, it's because in 1873 they had stopped the free coinage of silver. So effectively by 1873 the U.S. wasn't on a silver standard anymore, but technically it still wasn't on gold because of the, you know, leftover from the Civil War period. But by 1879, the U.S. was back on with, you know, you could turn in your dollar notes for gold. So if you had greenbacks that had been printed up during the Civil War era, by 1879, I believe you could turn those in, like a $10 piece of paper would give you a $10 double eagle gold coin.
From the government.
Right, because by 1879 they were back.
I mean, didn't Lincoln print a lot of greenbacks? Where in the heck would the government get all this gold to do that? I mean, do we know? I mean, they obviously had enough if the people were bringing it back.
Well, right. So that's why they didn't just do it right away, right? Because they went off the thing in 1861, you know, to pay the war, mm-hmm. and then of course the Confederate States did too. You know, they printed up a bunch of their currency, but you know, since they lost, that disappeared. But so even the, you know, the dominant Union army with their backs. And so the idea was I'm going to speak loosely here, but they printed up a bunch of money. So prices and dollars went way up. And so, yes, right at 1865, if they had said, okay, let's go back to the dollar being linked to gold at roughly $20.67 an ounce, mm-hmm. they would have been very deflationary, right? Because you're right. They didn't have enough gold to do that. They would have had to destroy paper money in order to be able to maintain that link. So instead, it was just a gradual process. So they basically let the economic output of the economy grow, and they only tried to tie the dollar back to gold as of 1879. So they basically waited, if you think about it, like 14 years. And so the idea was they slowed the printing of paper money so that prices quoted in dollars would gently come down over time, so that by the time they relinked, that yes, they did have enough gold reserves that they could satisfy that if people came and said, here's my paper dollars, give me gold coins, that they had enough gold on hand mm-hmm. to be able to do that.
Here's an email from George, wants to know, you skipped over it. Can you ask your guest why he believed that the whole the Revolutionary War was about? Was it about the money and King George not wanting them to use their own money, print their own dollars? Was that part of what it was about?
I've certainly read historians who argue that. Okay, so I'm just an economist. I'm not like a historian. Certainly not,
right.
And I don't even claim to be a monetary historian. This was right. thing I did for this book chapter. But yes, I definitely have read people who make the case that you learn in grade school oh, they didn't like taxation without representation.
Right, right.
And yes, as your listener is alluding to, that actually people have made the case that it was more subtle than that. That so certainly, as I said, for sure, it's undisputed, the colonists were using money besides official British currency. And they definitely were not, you know, if you went to the store, it wasn't that things were quoted in terms of pounds, shillings, and pence. That wasn't the issue. That wasn't the case. And so, again, it was the Spanish silver dollar was the predominant coin that they used. So, I have seen people make the case that part of what the British were concerned about was that the colonists were slipping away, gaining economic independence, not only by not paying taxes, but again, also by using currency outside of what they wanted in terms of a member of the British Empire. But I'm not enough of an expert to know whether I'm going to say yes to me that was the definitive cause or an important cause. I don't know enough about it.
Well, you write about it in this article, and you allude to the idea that with the gold standard and the fiat currency and all that, this is really as important as it's as important as the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as far as our freedom mm-hmm. and our liberty, right? And now we have I don't know what the number is. I bet it's close to 30 trillion out there floating around. I think that's pretty close. Shadowstats.com, I see, I think they're in that range. It's probably $30 trillion running around out there. So I guess it's fair to say that we've kind of lost a lot of liberty because of this, that we're kind of forced to
use? Oh, definitely. So what you're alluding to there is early on in the chapter, I quote from Mises.
Yes.
And he says, I'm paraphrasing, but this is pretty close to the quote. He's saying, people need to understand this idea of sound money.
Mm-hmm.
And that means money that's sound is like if somebody's of sound mind and body, like when they're writing their will, they mean, I have my faculties. I'm not sick. I'm making rational decisions. So sound money means sturdy, stable money, not like something that's being hyperinflated sort
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or debased by the crown. So Mises says what people need to realize is in the classical liberal worldview, like the 1800s who were trying to explain, these are the principles of limited government and economic liberty and so forth. He was saying the idea of sound money belongs in the same category as constitutions and bills of rights.
Mm.
So it wasn't just like a technical economic issue like, oh, hey, we've looked at history and we think that sound money or gold and silver work better than paper money for these technical. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that princes had debased the coinage, and so just like you would want a free press to protect your liberty, that if the government can tell newspapers what to print, then you don't have a free society. Likewise, if the government can come in and just debase the currency, you don't have a free society.
So
it wasn't like a narrow economic technical point. It was more about protecting the people's liberty. They need a free press and they need free money, as it were, meaning money free from political interference. And that's what sound money was. And that's why like a gold standard, Mises thought, was good to tie the hands of government. Just like you want the police to have a warrant to search your house. The government can't just print money. It needs to be shackled down to say like, oh no, you got to be able to redeem the paper with gold, for example. Like that means the government's ability to run the printing press.
The name of this paper on the Mises website is Understanding Monetary Money Mechanics, right? Money Mechanics.
Right.
And we're talking to Robert Murphy about that. And check it out. Stay right there, Sarah, and we're gonna take a little break here, and then we'll be back. This is fun stuff, man. I love talking about this because this gets right to the nitty gritty. If you're watching on our website, you'll see a little picture here of this. This machine, it's probably one of the more exciting technologies that I've come across in, my whole career talking about natural health, and which began in the late 70s when I was working for a big radio station in New Orleans, and I got kind of all jazzed up about natural health. And, of course, after talking about it for 2 years on a radio station like WWL, owned by the Jesuits, I got fired. But, that's what happens. Anyway, this is one of the most exciting technologies and you can imagine the things that I've tried and the supplements I've taken and all that, but this is the real deal, folks. Check it out. And it's an investment. Listen. Many people have said, and we concur, that the number one investment we should make is in our health. Here's George Wiseman.
Last caller, I'm sorry, I didn't remember his name, said an investment. And this is really the investment kind of thing that you need to do. Not my machine specifically. I think I sell the world's best machine, and I do my best to maintain it and support the customers and everything. But regardless of who you get it from, you really should invest in your health. How are you going to enjoy life if you haven't got health? How are you going to fulfill that bucket list? So number one on the bucket list should be your health, and then you get some extra years. I say this thing not only adds years to your life, because the science is showing a 30 to 50% life extension. So I'm expecting to go to the 120, 150 years old, and I'd help a lot of people between now and then. But it also adds life to your years. There's no sense living in your last decade of life if you're in a hospital bed attached to machines, you know what I mean? Throwing a Frisbee and having fun.
It's so true, isn't it? Boy, if we don't feel good and have the energy to do what we need to do, I mean, what's the point? And here's an investment with a lifetime warranty and also a 1 year, no questions asked, money back guarantee if you don't want it. Check out this AquaCure machine, bubbling hydrogen gas, drinking it, breathing it. This is real cutting-edge technology. Check it out in our store. Use promo code ONERADIO for a 10% discount. The AquaCure Brown's Gas Machine, OneRadioNetwork.com. I mentioned Andrew Goss leading into Mr. Murphy and my mentor in monetary history, who I have known for 25 years. And I remember the day I first saw him. It was in the early 90s. He was on a PBS channel talking about how the Federal Reserve Bank, the Fed, was not federal. And I go, what? And so I called him, we became good friends. And the fellow that hosted the show, a black fellow, he was later fired from national television, public television. Anyway, here's Andrew and his company and about numismatics. So if you want to get involved after listening to Mr. Murphy and others with getting yourself some real gold and silver, we like numismatic coins, real American money. That's our first choice. And listen to Andrew. Previously with Andrew Goss, I asked him, why would someone want to buy coins from his company?
So if you don't know coins, you better know your coin dealer. And, you know, you shouldn't buy coins from someone who isn't well-known registered dealer. So if they're an NGC dealer, they're registered with NGC. If they're a PCGS dealer, they're registered with PCGS. Ask questions. Don't just, oh, yeah, here's 10 grand or 50 grand or 150 grand. I just want to buy coins. You know, let me know what I'm getting. And no, that's not how an intelligent investor does it. And we do not let you do that. So if you're not willing to learn about the coins that you're buying, maybe you should find another coin firm. Don't call this one, because we're going to insist that you know why and how a coin is rare. And once you know that, then I think you can take that knowledge into the marketplace and make intelligent investment decisions.
Intelligent, yeah. Now, Andrew, as you know, he passed on, it's getting close to 2 years, and his longtime partner, Fred Dashevsky, has carried on. They've rebranded for all kinds of, you know, business, you know, legal stuff. And it's U.S. Coin Capital, U.S. Coin Capital, like the capital. And he's got a great website. So if you're interested in numismatics, that's real American money printed at the mint, St. Gaudens, and go back and get some real fun stuff that have collectible value as well as, coin value. And then they also have what they call currency silver. So you can get some pre-64 dimes, quarters, halves, and silver dollars and invest in silver that way. And we'll talk more about silver with Mr. Murphy. So that's kind of fun. And his number is 878-468-2646. 878-468-2646. U.S. Coin Capital. They're not going to try to sell you a bunch of stuff that you don't need. He's a good man. I've known Fred forever. This is the place to go. Don't buy coins from someplace on late night TV when you've had too much pizza and beer. You know, you're liable to not make the best decision.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.
We're talking about the gold standard idea with Robert Murphy of Mises, Mises.org. Robert, when did you get all juiced up about Mises and real money and gold? And what was it for you in your life? What was your turning point?
That's a good question. So definitely like Mises and the Austrian school, that stuff was in high school. My dad was into conservative politics, and so we got this thing called the Conservative Chronicle, and it had people like Cale Thomas and Mona Charon and stuff like that. But the ones I liked the most were by Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell, who were economists.
Yeah.
And then I just started reading more, and I read Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, and you know he had a lot there about like the perils of printing, why printing money doesn't lead to prosperity and stuff like that. And that got me into the Austrian school. Murray Rothbard was big. As far as the gold standard, though, I think reading Mises' earlier stuff, like I said, his 1912, The Theory of Money and Credit, and that's just seeing his remarks there, like I realized how much at that time, like they really thought of gold was the money, and the French franc and German mark and whatever were just sort of sovereign labels, but underlying it was the gold bullion, like in terms of large shipments, was the money, and these other things were sort of incidental. And so and then it really was a project, though I didn't fully appreciate just how much the gold standard was destroyed by World War I, that even when countries sort of went back on gold in the 20s, like just to give one example, like you learn that Great Britain under Winston Churchill was the head of the exchequer, went back on gold in the mid-20s, but even there it wasn't like citizens could go turn in British pounds and get gold. Like it was, you had to have a large quantity. I think it was like 400 ounces or something like that. To have the redemption. So still it was a much weaker check. It never went back to the pre-World War I classical era of what we people call the classical gold standard. And so,
yeah,
among other things, to blame the Great Depression on the gold standard is crazy. That they went off the gold standard, earned a bunch of money, and then didn't want to go back on its full discipline, and that sort of hodgepodge system didn't work, and then people blame the chaos in the 30s on the gold standard when they didn't obey it.
But you write about, and so the late 1800s then all the way up to World War I, we were on a gold standard, correct, with the dollar, where you could walk into a bank and you give them a buck and you got whatever. And how did they do that? How would you parcel out so many grains of gold or silver from a bank? I don't understand that.
Okay, so my understanding is what would happen is that you would, like if you had a $10, so to answer your other question too, I just Googled to make sure I had my dates right.
That's right.
Gold certificates in terms of things that the U.S. federal government issued that were saying this thing entitles me, the U.S. government's holding gold on my behalf, as it were. They started issuing those during the Civil War. So, right, so in other words, when they started printing greenbacks that were not backed up by gold, they also had gold certificates. So those things, I think it was 1863 maybe, was the first time they issued that. Mm-hmm. And that was up until 1933 when FDR, confiscated all the physical gold and, all these gold certificates.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, though,
I
think what it was is if you went into like a bank or, to a place like a government building and you had like a $10 greenback, mm-hmm, after 1879, you could turn that in and they would give you a single gold eagle, $10 gold
piece. Oh, I see. That's how they did it. Yeah.
Right. So that, in other words, so it was like you were giving them $10 in paper and they were giving you $10 in coin that was a full bodied coin. So yeah, they wouldn't give you like a pile of grain, gold grains, but they would give you the coins.
And
the so-called free coinage, though, this is another subtlety. So the free coinage meant if you brought actual gold bullion, they would take that and stamp it into gold coins. Right? You know I mean, so if you gave them the right amount of physical gold in raw form, as it were, they stamp it into legal money at the appropriate conversion.
Oh, and then people would actually bring in gold and take paper for it?
No, they would bring in like raw gold and then get the gold coins.
Oh, I see.
So in other words, like if you had bricks of gold or bricks of gold that didn't say, they would stamp them into discs that said like, $10, $10 US dollars, and it would be official currency. Okay. And that's what they discontinued. So when they discontinued the free coinage of silver, they stopped doing that. And that's, you know, like William Jennings Bryan's famous thing about
cross of gold.
You will not crucify us on a cross of gold. They wanted the free coinage of silver. That's what they wanted. They wanted to be able to bring silver that was raw and then stamp it into silver dollars. But they had discontinued doing that.
So then to fight World War One, they went off the gold standard and started printing dollars and borrowing dollars or whatever they did at the time.
Okay, so here's a subtle thing. So yeah, in World War One, just about all the belligerents abandoned their respective currencies, pledges to gold.
Yeah.
So the Germans, the mark was no longer redeemable in gold. And the U.S. government was relatively maintained faithfulness. So there, like U.S. citizens could still turn in like 27 cents and get. But what Woodrow Wilson did was he forbade the export of gold bullion and coin. So in other words, like international investors and other foreign banks and whatever couldn't get gold out of the U.S. So he didn't like formally drop the dollars tied to gold. He just said you can't export gold out of the country, and so that limited it. But that was less of a leaving of the gold standard than the other powers did.
Yeah. And then so what was going on in 1933 when Roosevelt said, he actually did an executive order, right? And said, you can't hold gold anymore. It's illegal. Bring it in. We're going to give you 20 bucks. What was it at that time? Do you remember? Do you know what they actually gave people?
Sure. Right. So, and this was sort of amazing that
that they did it, right? They pulled it off.
Right. Because the way it's taught, like nowadays, like when Judy Shelton or somebody speaks favorably of the gold standard.
Sure.
All the, you know, responsible people, you know, financial Twitter and whatever, like will roll their eyes and say, oh, the U.S. was on gold. And the reason we went off gold in the 30s was because it wasn't working. No, it wasn't that we went off gold. It was that FDR said, you will turn in your gold or else you get a $10,000 fine or you go to prison.
Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of a different. It wasn't that Americans across the board said, you know, I would rather have paper dollars than gold. No, they were forced to at gunpoint, literally. So yes, in 33, people had to turn in their gold. So the original ratio was $20.67 with rounding for an ounce of a troy ounce of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So people who turned in their gold, like let's say you had 100 ounces of gold, you had to turn that in to avoid jail time and a huge fine. And they would give you $2,067 in U.S. currency, like, you know, paper notes,
yes,
pictures of dead president, $100
yes,
bills.
Right.
Okay. And then, because that was the official thing. And then a year later, they revalued gold at $35 an ounce.
Oh, good for them.
So if you think about it, just even that move, I know you're being sarcastic,
no,
was slippery, right? So they pointed guns at people, took the gold, and gave them $20.67 per ounce. And then a year later said, now gold is worth $35 an ounce. So they stole everybody's gold at gunpoint and then made the gold worth more.
Brilliant.
In terms of dollars.
Brilliant.
So that's kind of a move.
So, I mean, holy, yeah, that's brilliant. It's amazing, though. Of course, nobody would know if people had the gold. Did you think, do we know historically if people really did this in full force because out of fear? Or we have no way of knowing who did it and who didn't, right? I mean, who would know?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's a part of it's like, you know, owning a bunch of cocaine is illegal. I mean, nobody in the
bring
U.S.
it
owns
in, right?
Cocaine, right?
Yeah,
so there's that
it.
Issue. But what they did do is, before FDR seized everybody's gold, the first executive, the executive order that did the so-called banking holiday, part of one of the clauses in there was he told all the banks, give us the information on any of your clients who have dealt with gold, I think going back to February of that year.
Wow.
And so the banks were, you know, sort of like a know your customer kind of thing. So the banks turned over the information. So to answer your question, Patrick, yeah, I'm sure there were people that didn't turn in their gold, but the idea was if you had like been using your safe deposits or just making large transactions earlier that year with your bank because it was legal and everything, then you would know they knew you had done that. Sort of like if you're worried about them confiscating your gun and you have registered your gun legally, they know you own it. You know, so it was that kind of a deal.
Right. Yeah. And then do we know, Robert Murphy, back then, would people have little bars and little one-ounce bars or – did they actually, they didn't turn in real money though, did they? Real American money, correct? That was not, like if you had a numismatic coin back then, you didn't have to bring that in according to FDR's edict.
Okay, so this is a good question, and I'm not like a legal scholar here, but the distinction that was made was some you could retain gold, the small amounts that were like had numismatic value.
Yes, that's okay, how.
But in standard in terms, of, so certainly yes, people who had like bars like bricks of gold, they had to turn that.
That's
in,
what
obviously.
They wanted. Yeah, that's what they
but
wanted.
My understanding is even if you just had regular coins, you know, like a $10 or a $20 gold double gold eagle. I think you had to turn those in too. So it was more like if you had some coin that was issued from, you know, Spain in 1800s that was a collector's item, you didn't have to turn that in because it wasn't monetary gold. So the distinction was
monetary
if
gold.
It was so-called monetary gold, you had to turn it. So yes, if you had a $10 gold piece that said, you know, $10 and it was gold, you had to turn that in. But if you had some collector's item that, oh, this is a rare coin.
Like a $20 gold piece, St. Gaudens of the 20s, right? That was real American money. You didn't have to turn that in.
No, I think you did.
You really? Oh,
I'm getting that.
Oh, I didn't. I thought it was otherwise, but you may be right. I don't know. So, okay. So, so then what happened? What happened to, did the country get back to any kind of a gold standard after the Roosevelt thing, after the war?
Okay, so, right. So in
we're moving up here towards the,
right as the war became, you know, as it became clear that the Allies were going to win World War II, they had the famous Bretton Woods conference. You know, it was in the Mount Washington Hotel. It happens to be in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, and so that's where they hammered out what the post-war world monetary arrangement was going to be. Originally, they thought it was going to be like British pounds and U.S. dollars, but then just as things progressed, the U.S. so eclipsed Great Britain that in practice it was a dollar standard. So the idea was all the major central banks of the world defined their currencies with respect to U.S. dollar, you know, at a fixed ratio. So like, you know, the U.S. dollar versus the French franc or the German mark or the Italian lira, the British pound exchanged at fixed ratios. But then the U.S. dollar itself, they pledge those central banks, hey, if you want, you can always exchange your dollar claims for gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. So technically the world was, so the term economists use is to say that wasn't really a gold standard, it was a gold exchange standard. That's the term they use, saying it was really like a dollar standard, but since the dollar itself, in theory, is still redeemable in gold, it was loosely tied to gold, but under the classical gold standard, anybody, any citizen, anybody of the world could exchange. You know, the respective authorities were pledged to redeem their currencies for gold, and anybody could do it. Whereas here, only central banks could do it, so that was a much weaker check. And also, the U.S. government would use diplomatic pressure. That in the '60s, with the war on poverty, the Vietnam War, the U.S. government was spending a lot of money, and the Fed was monetizing the deficits. So that was putting pressure on the dollar that, in other words, gold should have been more than $35 an ounce. And so, especially like with the French government, they sort of blinked first and said, you know what? You know, we were accumulating all these dollar assets.
Give us our gold.
So like the U.S. government or the U.S. was running trade deficits because they were printing dollars, and other foreign banks were just piling up dollar claims. Like that was the way that the trade accounts were settling. The U.S. government was basically saying behind the scenes, hey, don't knock over the apple. We don't have enough gold. If you all turned in your dollar claims and wanted gold, we wouldn't run out. We don't want that to happen. So just trust us. Just keep letting those dollar claims pile up. And finally, the French government in the late 60s said, this is crazy. And we want our gold. And so like London and, you know, and New York started having their gold being drained. And then that caused a problem. And then the U.S. government was, you know, behind the scenes, the other central banks, please don't run on the dollar, because otherwise. And then finally, by 71, it just the pressure became too much, and Nixon formally
said
to the world, "You know what? And it was funny too, because he said this is just going to be temporary.
Did he really?
And he assured people, "Don't worry, the dollar is not going to be hurt by this. The dollar will be strengthened by this." And we all saw what happened with consumer prices in the 70s.
Could you use your imagination? I mean, this is just very conjecture, but just for fun, of who was it that told old, I am not a crook, Tricky Dick, to do this? I mean, somebody had to push his buttons on this one. Who would do that? Who would have the power to do that?
Well, I mean, he had lots of advisors behind the scenes. I'm not sure like which one of them in particular had his ear and, you know, it was the one that made the case. I do know, because I used to work for Arthur Laffer. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. He told me, you know, that, you know, he was much younger, that he said we were against it. Like, so he and his group, he thought it was a bad idea. So they didn't want Nixon to do that. They thought it was going to be bad for but the other forces won the day. And it's ironic because us now, it's so obvious severing the dollar from gold meant the dollar's value was going to plummet.
Yeah.
But yet there were people at the time that said it the other way around. They thought that this was going to strengthen their by freeing it from its link to this mere commodity. Mm-hmm. So it's just funny how people had different views.
I would suspect then that the people that owned and operated the Fed, the big banks in 33, they must have been all in on that, because why would they want gold to hamper their ability to issue currency? True or not? What do you think?
So I think you're right. So, I mean, presumably there you know, were people on Wall Street and whatnot that had sound views and realized this is a bad idea. We don't want to go down this path. But yes, let me put it to you this way, Patrick. You may have seen these like studies about income inequality, and they show that like middle class or working class wages, blue collar wages, became stagnant.
Right.
From a certain point. Yeah. And they try to blame it on Ronald Reagan. Like, you clearly these people don't like the Reagan years. But if you actually look at their own charts, where the turnaround happened was in the early 70s. It was in 1973 is where there's this inflection point. And so I always point out that, what was the major change that happened that could have explained this dramatic shift in like the fortunes of the top 1% versus the working man that happened in the early 70s? And to me, it's clearly going off, you know, going off gold. So to answer your question, I think you're right that when you unshackle the Fed and allow them to print money and buy assets, what kind of people are going to be able to reap gains in that sort of environment where, you know, there's money moving around and the fast money is the one who makes the gains and the sucker who gets left holding the bag? To me, clearly, the speculators, the people running hedge funds and whatnot, they're the ones that are going to speculate in commodities and be able to anticipate and front run the Fed, like know something's going to happen before it becomes common knowledge. Yes, and position their portfolio. Whereas somebody who's just earning a salary working at the Ford plant, you know, their wages are going to be slow to respond. So they're going to see prices go up first, and then maybe their wages respond after a lag. So they're going to be the ones that are going to be hurt by the inflation.
So with Johnson then in Vietnam, and then I guess, who was after Johnson? Nixon, right? Was it Nixon? Nixon, right? They were borrowing. Right. They were borrowing a lot of money, mostly from the Fed, I think, and the market, to run the war. So were those dollars in theory still exchangeable, late 60s, early 70s, before Nixon took them off? I guess they were.
Right. And so just to clarify, we speak loosely and say, the Fed was monetizing the debt, but strictly speaking, it was a shell game, right? So when the federal government, the U.S. Treasury had
created enough.
It auctions them off to people in the private sector. But the idea is, if the Fed then, as part of its monetary operations, its open market operations, buys treasury debt and creates dollar assets to do so, effectively the Fed is the one that's taking the new debt onto its balance sheet and printing dollars, right? So it's more subtle than just a crude running the printing press to pay the government's bills.
Right.
But effectively it's the same thing, when all is said and done. But yes, to answer your question, up until Nixon does that in 71, strictly speaking, remember, it's not regular Joe Schmo. It's only foreign central banks had the legal ability to turn in their dollar assets to get gold. And so, like I say, they were sort of using diplomatic pressure. In other words, had those central banks done so, the game would have been ended earlier because the U.S. didn't have enough gold to satisfy them. So it's sort of like a regular bank. If all the depositors run and they want their money out, the bank's going to fail. It was that kind of a deal, that there were more dollar claims than the U.S. government could satisfy with the amount of gold that it had in its vaults.
Robert Murphy is with us at Mises.org, and you can look at his work on gold, and then also check out the paper that I'm going to look into called Understanding Money Mechanics on Mises.org. So was there a time after 33 in your, this may be more legal stuff, but Robert, somebody said, okay, well, it's okay for you to own gold? Was there some kind of a legislation or executive order, or did it just kind of wear out because nobody cared anymore? Do you know?
Let me see.
I don't know.
Yeah, so I think it was in 74.
74.
Okay, so yeah, I'm just looking at it. On January 1st, 1975, these restrictions were lifted.
Ah.
Okay, so from 33 to apparently January 1st, 1975, regular American citizens literally couldn't even own gold, period, let alone was dollar redeemable.
Right.
And then they let them do it. The other thing that's interesting, Patrick, is just to drive home to people how much they didn't want Americans using gold as the money was, it wasn't merely that in 33 you had to turn in your physical gold and you couldn't contract in that, but also you couldn't even, they outlawed what were called gold clauses. So you couldn't even say things like, oh, okay, this worker is going to work for my company 40 hours a week, 2 weeks vacation, blah, blah. Every month I will pay him the equivalent of, we'll check the world price of gold and I'll pay him in dollars the equivalent of, 1 ounce of gold.
Right.
You couldn't even do that. Like they would say, that's not an enforceable contract. So it's not only that you couldn't physically hand them gold as the payment, but you couldn't even make the dollar amount that your liability was dependent on the world price of gold. So you could sort of indirectly as if you were paying them in gold. You couldn't even, those weren't even legally enforceable in contracts. So, I mean, they really wanted to make it so that people were not using gold as money and they were using the dollar. And again, so that's why it's so funny when people say, oh, we went off gold because it didn't work well. No, they were forced to.
And so, of course, that period you're talking about, I guess gold at the early stages was, what, $35 an ounce, and then you run up all the way through Carter and all that whole thing and the inflation, and then, what, 1980 or 81, what was gold? $850. That's a huge, doesn't seem like a lot with 2,000 gold today, but that was a huge upswing in those years, right? Can you conjecture who the forces were behind that wanted to give Americans the ability to own gold again in mid-70s? I mean, why would they do that, whoever the money people are? Why would they do that? I wonder, do you have any ideas?
Another thing too in that history is at some point gold got officially revalued again at like $42.
Okay.
Now, something like that, I have the number
and
right.
And then it works.
So like now, if you... Right. So, I mean, the difference between like the spot world price versus like the official. So right now, if you go and look at like the U.S. government's assets in terms of like how they report it, in terms of their just accounting, principles, they'll, they have real estate, they have buildings, they have all kinds of, coal or things like this. And they also, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and they also have gold holdings, and they value them at $42.
$42,
an ounce,
yeah.
Even though obviously the market price of gold is way higher than that, and that's just a remnant from this period that after the 35 number that was set in 34, at some point they revalued it to $42 an ounce.
So you don't have any idea why they would allow people who the forces would be to allow people, Robert, to own gold back around 75. Why would they do that?
I can't prove this to you. Like I said, I don't really know the history of it in terms of who was agitating. But to me, I don't think it's a coincidence that once the dollar was formally severed from gold and it was no longer linked, that then they said, oh, if you want to just hold gold as a commodity, just like, you can hold baseball cards, or go ahead.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, in other words, the transition, the move, like to wean Americans from the from gold, so now we're just using dollars and that's what we think of as the money. Period. Since that had been completed in 71, like there was no reason not to let them own physical gold at that point. You know what I mean? So I think, I don't know if that's too simplistic an explanation, but before then, I think they didn't want Americans to still harbor this idea that the gold was really the money and we're just waiting, for this period to end when we're going to link the dollar back to gold. I think once they severed it and said, no, the dollar is the dollar, period. It's not redeemable in anything. At that point, yeah, go ahead and you can own gold. Who cares?
Yeah. Were you around then in the 70s when gold was moving up, and did you prosper with that? Did you buy some?
I was born in 1976.
Oh, so you were
I wasn't speculating on gold at that point.
You were just a kid. I have a great story for you. I interviewed Harry Brown. You know Harry, right? God love him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was interviewing Harry Brown on WWL Radio in New Orleans. I think it was 78, 79. And during a commercial, he said something like, Patrick, if you don't get anything else out of this interview, this is off the air, buy gold. Of course, you know, I was so enamored with girls and beer in New Orleans, I had no idea what he was even talking about. But that's my Harry Brown story. I guess I should have listened. Okay, can you stick around a few more minutes? Because I want to wrap it up and talk about present day.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's stay right there. And we are going to just do a quick little break here. And then we're going to get back into a few with Robert Murphy. This is fun stuff. So check it out.
Previously, we were talking with Dr. Rulin Shu, and I had a question about our Pearlseum. Pearlseum is not just calcium, right? It's calcium and minerals and proteins?
Yes. So the Pearlseum, the pearl, inside the pearl, there's, so of course, big part of it is calcium. But more importantly, this pearl contains all kinds of trace minerals, potassium, magnesium, zinc, selenium, and also all kind of trace minerals, proteins, amino acid, polysaccharides. So it is. It actually have a very balanced matrix of nutrients for the calcium metabolism. And in fact, they have research discovered that the pearl, the mechanism, you know, the DNA that in charge of making the pearl is very similar to the human DNA that in charge of calcium metabolism.
Yes, getting really good calcium in just the right spot, in the bones, that's where we need it, is a challenge, but this is a great product and it does that. And that's just one of the many benefits. Brush your teeth with it. It's the most amazing thing for teeth you've ever seen. They will look pearly white. Pearlseum. Click an order right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with Dr. Richard Ulrey and the relationship to the bacteria in our gut to everything.
There's tremendous communication between the gut bacteria in the brain through the vagus nerves.
Oh.
The brain doesn't necessarily make a lot of stuff. It's kind of like living on Hawaii. Everything has to be imported. 80% of what your brain needs is actually made by the gut bacteria for your brain to properly function and to regulate the rest of the body. Your gut bacteria is designed to make all of your vitamins. So if you're giving your patients vitamins, that means your gut bacteria is not making the vitamins for the body in question. I said, assuming you straighten out the gut and we've got all the right bacteria doing all the right things, making vitamins, the reason you need vitamins is so you can absorb minerals.
Ah, that's great. We're learning so much. We've always known the bacteria being important, but more and more. Wow. These Living Streams probiotics we're promoting, we believe they are some of the most bioactive, varied, unique human DNA probiotics in glass liquid available anywhere. All the products in our store, click on One Living Streams, and you'll get access to them all on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, I hope if you're having half as much fun as I am, then we're doing good. Robert Murphy is with us, senior fellow with the Mises Institute, author of many, many books, and they have a kind of a book that they're compiling there on Mises.org, which is Understanding Money Mechanics, that I recommend that you get and noodle in. I know it's a little geeky, but boy, if you really understand what could possibly be going on in the future, and we're going to talk with Mr. Murphy about that, with the dollar and how many is going to be putting out there and what your dollar may buy, more importantly, 10 years from now. I mean, that's important, Robert Murphy, isn't it? With all this, you know, quantitative easing and the COVID rescue.
Right.
You know, what people's 401k and Social Security and stuff will buy 10 years from now, that's mission critical, is it not?
It is, and I should have an ounce of humility here that I thought the sort of problem was going to manifest itself earlier. Like back in with the first rounds of QE in 2009, 2010, I thought we were going to see much more significant price inflation than
mm-hmm.
we did.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, I think part of what happened is that they had blown up such a big credit bubble that had the Fed not inflated, I think you would have seen prices come down a lot. Like, things would have gotten cheaper, and instead they sort of were like printing money to fill this black hole. But yes, I think you're right. And what's happening now, as we said in the beginning of this discussion, Patrick, how they've printed $3 trillion just in the last few months. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, unfortunately, I think the Fed has learned that, hey, whenever there's a crisis now, we just keep creating money and buying assets until Wall Street goes up. And so far, nothing bad's happened. So why not?
Why not?
And I think they're going to keep doing that, just keep upping the ante until something bad does happen.
Kind of like cocaine. You just keep doing it until something bad happens, right? But of course, as you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on with the Federal Reserve banks and BlackRock. And we don't really know. Right, because you can't look at their books. We don't really know. Thank you, Ron Paul. We don't really know how many dollars are out there, do they? I mean, they took away those metrics. What was it, in the late 90s, the M1, M2, and all that stuff? So we don't know. So let's do this before we go. So let's just conjecture that there's $30 trillion out there worldwide running around looking for some place to go. I think it's a pretty close number. It could be more, could be less, but just to say 30. And then we say, well, the government's got, I think, 255 million ounces of gold. That's what they say. Let's just give them that. You know, let's just say the 8,000 tons is accurate. So if you divide, I did the number on that, and I think it's, I don't know, $75,000 an ounce would be if you wanted to back them all by gold. So let's just say you did that. These Dollar Inc. people had way too much scotch one night. They wake up, and they say, well, let's just do this. You know, there's all kinds of things out there, as you know, on the interweb. Oh, we're going to go to the gold standard, and Trump is hiring Julie. He wants to appoint Julie Shelton, and she's a gold bug, and blah, blah. You know. So what would happen? Even if they would do it, say $75,000 an ounce gold overnight. Okay, here it is. We're backing by gold. What would happen? Is it even possible? I mean, just to say, sorry, long question. Let's just say do a magic wand thing and they do it. What would that do to the whole system, in your opinion?
Okay, so the great question, and it's, you're right. The problem with saying let's go back on gold is what ratio? Because a lot of people would say, oh, let's go back to the $42 an ounce, which was the thing, but why that? Why not the 35? Why not the $20.67, you know, which was the pre-1933 ratio? And so you're right. If they were to go back to those earlier ones, clearly they would have to just vacuum up and destroy lots of dollars to be able to maintain that pledge. And so prices in general would just collapse in order to get the market price of gold back in line with whatever the peg was. So, and that would be very painful. So then, you know, the issue is, okay, well, what if we did it the other way? So the proposal that I thought made the most sense is Mises himself in the 60s, I believe is when he penned this essay, came out with a thing about how could the U.S. go back on gold. And he was saying that you couldn't just do it in one fell swoop to make all dollars backed up 100% by gold. He was saying just make it so that going forward, any new dollars that are created have to be 100% backed by gold at the existing market price when that link was established. So right now we would go look at the market, whatever it is, $2,000 an ounce or whatever it is, and just say going forward, no commercial bank even, the government is not allowed to make more dollar claims unless someone comes and gives physical gold to back up those new dollar issues.
How would you keep them separate though? I mean, how could you do that? I mean, yeah.
Well, they wouldn't be. So you're right. It's, money's fungible. So it's not that, this dollar bill is backed up by gold, but this one isn't. But his point was that would immediately slow the creation of new money, and the quantity of gold reserves would start growing over time. And then, and that would lock in the price of gold at that amount. And so that would lock in the thing. And then, investors would have certainty. And over time, he was saying we would move towards dollars that were fully backed by gold.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that proposal is the end all be all, but I'm saying he did, try to come up with, because there's no, you're right, any other number they pick is going to be arbitrary. So it's got to kind of be tied to the current market price. But yet, as you mentioned, the problem is right now at the current market price, all the dollars, we don't have enough gold in the vaults.
No.
And so,
and what would that do?
Let me put it this way, Patrick.
Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. What would that do, though?
Well, I was going to say, the problem with doing it your way would be if he if they announced we're going to redeem gold at the or dollars at the rate of $75,000 an ounce, right? That would imply there's going to be a lot more inflation, right? Because right now gold's not priced that much, so people might think, "Wow, are they going to really crash the dollar?" If you see what I'm saying,
yeah.
So,
right.
So that's
or and
that,
it
so
would also
that's the issue.
It would also, in a sense, make the dollar appear more valuable, and people wouldn't spend them. That's possible too, and that would. That
right.
screws up everything, right? If you screw up velocity, right?
Yeah. Right. So the big, I mean, I probably jumped too much into the details. So the claim, like the reason somebody like a Judy Shelton, what you're trying to do is to reassure people that yeah. you're going to strengthen the dollar. Right now, the dollar's not redeemable in anything.
Yeah.
You're just trusting that the Fed authorities won't print too many of them. And so by saying the U.S. government stands prepared to redeem dollars in terms of gold, you're at least backing it up by something. So in principle, if people believe that pledge, it makes the dollar stronger. So it strengthens against other currencies. Price inflation shouldn't be as much as it otherwise be. And so that it sort of locks it in. So that's the idea. That's the principle. So if you stick to a number and then didn't deviate from it, that would maintain the strength of the dollar over time. Just like under the classical gold standard, the dollar's purchasing power stayed the same, you know, it bounced around, but like over a 100-year stretch, the amount of stuff you could buy with an ounce of gold was about the same in the end of that period, whereas now, obviously, that's not true.
Robert, if there was a way to back gold, just to say if there was a way hypothetically at some form, would it mean anything if you couldn't exchange it? In other words, they just said, well, we've got gold in mountains, and we got whatever, and we've got assets, and we're going to back it with this. Would it mean anything if you couldn't exchange it?
I don't think so. And that's why also I don't really like it when people say things like, oh, the dollar right now is backed up by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And I was like, well, what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Like, because I can't, you know, if I turn in a $20 bill, they'll give me two tens. So what is that? You know, if it's the dollar that I'm not sure of, just to be given other dollars denominations doesn't do anything for me. Whereas if they, like you're saying, Patrick, if they're prepared and say, we'll give you physical gold coins,
right. That's
well, then that does mean something. Right. And so I think you're right that it doesn't really make sense to say the dollar's backed up by something unless there is an actual
exchange,
action you can take
that right.
limits their ability. Because that's what you want. You want them to be afraid to print too many dollars.
Right. Because, China or Japan or whoever buys a lot of treasuries, I think China still has a trillion. It wouldn't mean anything to them if it wasn't exchangeable. They know there's no confidence in the dollar anyway. So finally, though, to wrap. So what about this? I dream about this idea. So say blockchain. What if you do a blockchain dollar and you say, okay, well, we've got 255 million ounces of gold, if we do. And again, when's the last time it's been audited? I don't know. Who knows how much Treasury really has. And then we have $30 trillion and you do the math and then you have 0.00000 86 ounces of gold per dollar, and it was a blockchain thing. I wonder, do you think that would has any light at the end of that tunnel?
So certainly what you could use blockchain technology for was to have an unambiguous public ledger, is to say who is the rightful owner, you know, of these bars of gold or this physical stuff, but still in terms of the custody, in other words, like what the blockchain, you know, what the, you know, Satoshi's white paper and all that stuff, the public private key cryptography shows how I can safely like transfer my bitcoins to you, for example. But if there's gold located in some vault somewhere, like to the men guarding that with guns still need to obey whatever the public ledger says. And if they decide not to obey that, you get what I'm saying? Like, just the mere fact that everybody around the world who has a computer can agree, oh no, this guy in New Zealand, he's the rightful owner of those 3 ounces of gold that's being held in the Fed's vault. If the president of the United States just says, yeah, but we don't want to have international speculators attacking the dollar, so we're suspending redemption right now.
Right. So what if there was no redemption, there was just, and they did a blockchain, do you think it would have any value to anybody to claim, well, the dollar's now gold back, even though it's only 0.000086 ounces for each dollar. Do you think that would have any value to anybody? No redemption.
I'm not sure, because there's no authority said we're going to maintain that. You know, that's our promise. We're going to, you know, like Howell at the next meeting said, right now there's this much gold content per dollar effectively, and we're going to strive going forward to make sure that the number doesn't go down.
Right, right.
To the extent that markets believe that, they might adjust things according to
their expectations. Might be worth something.
Right? If he's not, if there's nothing that would happen, if he's not going to lose his job if he doesn't live up to that, it's kind of an empty promise, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, though, maybe the 0.000086 would just change as they create more dollars without creating more gold. It would go up and down just like Bitcoin, right? So, in other words, couldn't you do it if it wasn't a standard? It was just, okay, this is what it is, and if it goes out and the government borrows 10 trillion or another 10, that would make that number 0.00000. Whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? With all this COVID thing and it seems that the only real thing the government can do with 27 trillion in bonded debt, is to keep going. Just, you know, Trump, he loves debt. He'll just keep borrowing money, won't he? I mean, do we just keep going till we run out of zeros and somebody just gives up on the dollar? What do you think the future is?
Right. Yeah, that's really the scary thing, is that even before the COVID hit, you know, the unemployment rate, and again, we know, like you talked about shadow stats.
Sure.
Obviously, the officials are bogus, but even though with the according to official figures, it was a time of relative prosperity just, you know, 8 months ago, and yet the government was still running huge budget deficits, right? So the idea is, in theory, it's supposed to be, oh yeah, when there's a bad economy, you run a deficit, and then when times are good, you run a surplus,
right,
to try to have a balanced budget, you know, over the cycle. And yet that's not what was happening. Even when Trump was bragging about having record low unemployment rates, they still had a huge budget deficit. So the idea is, if we're running huge debt deficits, even when times ostensibly are good, we're never going to dig out of this hole. And as you say, Patrick, it's the official numbers are awful. And then when you plug in the demographics with Social Security, in particular Medicare, like there's just no way, even the official actuarial reports, you know, the government's own bean counters have them in the hole, depending on how, you know, the window you use and the discount rate, like $40 trillion, something like that, or $40 to $70 trillion, right, depending on how you calculate it.
Right.
So, yeah, there's no way out of that. They're going to have to default in some way or another and or resort to printing money. And probably they'll do a combination of those things, you know, shave people's Social Security and Medicare, and then also, you know, run the printing press even more.
So for our listeners around the world, to kind of wrap, I mean, what else are you going to do except own gold or silver? Yeah, what else are you going to do? Do we have any other options, really, to protect ourselves?
Right. So that's a great question. So, yeah, I think that's that's correct. And also for people who are comfortable with cryptocurrency, I own some Bitcoin and things like that. It's, you know, I imagine if the dollar crashes, cryptocurrencies will respond well in that environment as well. But yes, I think you're right. That clearly, gold and silver are going to be valued. And we see how gold's, you know, hitting new peaks just with this recent uncertainty.
Yes, sir.
Thing too is, though, I also do think in the very short term, at least, even though it sounds paradoxical, having dollar assets also, at least some of them, is going to be useful too. That, like, I think, in other words, I would rather own bonds right now than stocks.
Sure.
Like the next year or two. Whereas, like, over the next 30 years, I think U.S. bonds are going to be terrible. So it's a weird thing where it's not merely that there's going to be a currency problem. I think the real economy is also in bad trouble.
Sure.
And so I don't even own, you know, companies located in the Western economies right now, because I think they're going to get hit.
Yeah. So finally, I keep saying finally, We go back, and the ratio was like 15-16 of gold to silver, and today it's like, what is it? I divided it this morning. If I could look in my notes, I divided 2,000 by 25. What is it, 80-1? So does that mean,
something like that, yeah.
Does that mean that silver, all the silver bugs are going to finally see their day? Some, do you think? I mean, do you think silvers could make a real move? Of course, the silver bugs have been saying that for 20 years, right? Ever since it went up
to
50.
Right, right. So I don't think there's any natural reason that, in other words, I don't think like the 15 or 16-1 ratio, there's something
doesn't matter
about the essential nature of those commodities or metals. Because remember, those numbers were prevailing back when the major governments of the world were on what was called bimetallic standards.
Mm-hmm.
But in the, through the 1870s, all the major governments demonetized silver. And so they moved a lot of the demand for silver. And that sort of is one of the reasons that its market price relative to gold went down. So that's my long way of saying, right, that did surprise me when, to see those numbers and how the ratios moved like that. But I think that's a reflection that right now, a lot of people still think of gold as money, but not as many people think of silver as money.
I see.
If that's a simple, so the people that do think it is, yeah, they could maybe say, oh, over the next 20 years, I think silver is going to respond better than gold will, and they very well may be right. I'm just saying, though, that back when we looked at the 15 or 16-1 ratio, that was a period when silver was also being stamped into coins and used as money.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Murphy, you're fun to talk to. Thanks for being here. We appreciate it. And we're going to have the links to your work and to Mises on our show page if you'd like to learn a little bit and send your kids to homeschooling, as long as they're home, right? As long as they're home, let them learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Robert, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Patrick. I enjoyed it.
I really had a good time. Thank you, sir. Robert Murphy, Mises.org. Looks like we're having a little problem with our stream on the, but I don't know what it is. But anyway, so we'll just kind of move out of here. I will see you tomorrow, and we're going to have Richard Mayberry at 10:30, and he's an Austrian guy. Early warning report. And we're going to also have somebody else in the morning. Join us. I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support, and we'll see you in the morning, 9 o'clock Central Time. May the blessings be.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.